Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. Get in, loser! Mean Girls is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Join Katie Heron as she meets the plastics and Tina Fey's new twist on the modern classic. Get ready for more of the rumors, backstabbing, and jokes you loved from the original movie with some fetch surprises. Rated PG-13. Wear pink and head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful week so far. Podcast time. Jody Wistanoff. Many of you will know Jody through his Anjuna Deep releases, through his Progressive House career, and some of you may know him through his Way Out West days, and some of you may know him from even before that. In this podcast, we get to go into Jody's history and how it all started for him. He is a fellow Bristol artist, born and bred and still in Bristol, which is special. Loved having this conversation with them. So without further ado, Jody Wistanoff, what's cooking, man?
Yes, Will. How you doing, geez?
Good, mate. How are you?
Yeah, nice, mate. Nice.
This is
sweaty.
Yeah, mate. It's pretty warm outside. This is when both of our Somerset accents are going to come out. It's going to be
Blubber.
It's going to be like a proper farmer podcast.
So, what are you in? You're in Somerset at the moment then?
Yeah, I'm in near Cheddar, in between. Whereabouts are you?
Bristol.
Are you in Bristol?
Yeah, in Clifton Village. We've been here born in Bristol, but we're still here. It's mental, man.
That's crazy. Yeah. What was it like? How long are you, how old are you?
Guess.
I don't know, man. Because I know you've been in it for a long time.
Mate, yeah. I mean, I could be your dad, put it that way. Kind of. No, I'm 48.
Man, damn,
1, 2, 3, 3. So yeah, it's really weird, man. It's like it just sort of, but take 2 years off COVID because they didn't really count, did they? So,
I know, literally it was like years, it was I was 30 in COVID and then 31, and then when this podcast comes out, it's I'm 32. I was 32 on Monday, just gone.
It's your birthday, isn't it? Yeah,
just gone.
If I was like, I'd give you the bumps if I was.
But yeah, it's mad how much time we kind of just like evaporated during COVID, right?
Completely, and it almost seems like it didn't happen. Now it's like, especially when you go to airports and it's, you know, business as usual, just hecticness.
Yeah. Until you like have to start doing tests to get into like countries, and you're like, oh, for fuck's sake.
I had to do that the other day, man. I had to get into New Zealand. So it just felt really weird having to do a test again.
Well, because I do so much in the States, I have to test like every other week just to get in.
Cause really?
Because you have to test to go into America.
Not at the moment, I don't think so. It's my main territory as well, pretty much. But
yeah, you have to test. You have to do a LLFT beforehand.
It's the easy one though, isn't it?
Super easy. Up your nose,
Yeah.
But it's just, it's so annoying having to test. So annoying.
Yeah. I mean, especially if you do test positive and you feel completely fine, you're like, no.
Yeah. I guess, like, what? I don't know. It's not really my place to say, but I feel like just fucking go. Fuck it.
It's fading, mate. I can give it another 6 months. It's just going to be completely. We won't even think, you know, we'll forget.
Hopefully. Hopefully, no, man. I think we need to crack on back to normal. But anyway, how's it going? Yeah. How's life?
Yeah, good, man. Just got back from Australia a couple of days ago. So, got straight into, like, you know, I just like to go into my normal routine when I get home. So, you know, back in the day when I was a bit younger, I'd be like, oh, I've got jet lag. Just another day to rest. It's like, oh, my head hurts. But when you get to the ripe old age of 48, you just gain this weird strength. And you're like, right, I'm up at 7:30 in the morning, fucking in the gym.
Just keep going.
Yeah, just totally, mate.
Well, you've been doing it for so long, I'd like to think you're used to it now.
You do. It's weird, man. You do kind of get more used to it.
Yeah.
Like, I think about to sort of like, you know, my early 20s and stuff like that, and it was a lot harder, man.
Yeah.
Like, when I first started going to the States and stuff, I just find it's like, whoa, like a 6-hour flight to, or 7-hour flight to New York was like, wipe me out.
Mm.
That's like nothing now. It's
easy, isn't it?
You do it every day.
Yeah. You do it every weekend, don't you? And it's just like,
really, it's a non-issue. So
it's so weird what we get used to, right, as human beings, and like how, especially us as touring artists, how we get used to traveling. Because, like, I'm sure it's the same for me, but I'm sure you have, like, friends that, like, you talk to and they're like, I can't believe you're flying to America and you'll be back on Monday.
Completely. That, you know, it blows their mind.
Yeah. And it's, like, so weird to them, which I understand. It is weird, but it's so strange how we get used to just flying so much.
I mean, it just becomes, I actually find it quite a peaceful spot, to be honest, because generally, most flights don't have Wi-Fi. I mean, some of the American ones do and stuff, but, you know, it's a chance to just kind of do your own thing, really, and not have to think about all, you know, you can just communicate with yourself and just sort of go inwards, and it's quite nice, man.
Yeah, what do you do on the plane?
I do a lot of music, actually. Just more like, nothing like really intricate, but just more like sort of programming drum beats and stuff like that,
yeah.
And just about, like, soft synths, just, like, fanning around.
Just chilling in, like...
Some people are really into that, and some people really aren't into it. You know, they're like, you know, I just like, you know, watch box sets when I travel, you know, making things with you. But I don't know. I find it really calming down, making tunes. It's just like, it's mellow, man. It's like a form of meditation.
Yeah, it depends for me. I have to be in the right mood to write music on a plane. Or I have to have like a specific idea that I'm like, I know what I need to do, and I need to finish this idea that I've got in my head.
Yeah, so you're one of those guys that, I bet when you eat one bit of food each of time, don't you?
100%. Yeah, no, if I'm going to like a gig and I'm like, I have an idea of an edit that I want to make, I'll make it.
Edits are great when you're traveling as well, yeah. Definitely. You just sort of like working on your set and your planning stuff. And then you find like little wicked samples and things and stuff. And
yeah.
I do the loops and, you know, you work on your record box and blah, 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 blah. So...
Yeah, you know, I like doing stuff like that.
Yeah,
and it always sounds like shit. But there's
which headphones? Do you mean the result or the actual sound on a plane?
Well, the result, like, there's always like the bass is always way too high or something.
Yeah, when you do like a rough mix down on a plane, it's mental.
It's terrible. I remember. Yeah, I'm like, fuck me, I should not be playing this, but fuck it.
You get a little bit excited, don't you? Like, you kind of land in 2 hours and you're on. You're like, let's bust this.
Yeah, let's bang it out. I use the Bose noise cancelling ones as well.
Yeah, I like them. I actually mix down. But it's part of the process of mixing down is like checking on those, but when I'm at home,
really,
you have like the noise cancelling mode on, but no noise. And I don't know, I'm just like so used to how they sound now that it's part of the deal of, you know, the many pronged attack of a mix down when you're working in like a home studio and not a proper studio where it actually sounds like it should, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Unless you've got like a studio built from the ground up, you are kind of lagging it,
yeah.
And it's so hard to get the low end right, man. It's so tricky.
Well, I think also it's like if you've not got the right studio, and you've also probably, if you've not got the right studio, you've probably not got the right speakers. And it's like none of us, not everyone can afford fucking 20 grand speakers, and not everyone can afford a fucking
built into the wall. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. Like it's just it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's like it's not really thinkable, is it?
Yeah. But have you tried the new Apple? The over-ear headphones.
I've heard about it. Were they talking about that on our WhatsApp group the other day?
Yeah,
I
think yeah. They one. Yeah, I bought it up. They're fucking great.
Okay, wait a minute. So they're like Apple actual headphones that you, not the ones
is that you... One sec, mate. Can you sit a bit closer to you? Is your microphone...
How's that, mate?
That's so much better.
Oh, shit. Sorry, dude.
No, that's fine. It's fine. It's just a bit weird. So I was like, it sounded... Yeah. I was wondering. Yeah, they're really good.
I might have to check them. I might buy a pair for my daughter's birthday and then just take
borrow
them.
they're super expensive though. They're like 500 quid.
Yeah, God, that's quite pricey for like non sort of studio specific headphones, isn't it?
Yeah, like they're not like open ear or open air or something like that. But like, I'm debating about getting a pair. But the only thing is that I know the battery is not going to last as long as the Bose, because the Bose ones, I feel like the battery lasts for like 10 years.
Yeah, totally, man. You charge, and it takes about 2 seconds to charge up.
Yeah.
It's like, whoop, you're at 100%.
Quickly, let's go. Yeah, man.
It's with the cables, though, because like, if you're plugging it in, if you're on a plane and the cable snaps, they're really hard to find.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It goes from like mini jack to mini, mini, mini jack.
Yeah.
Weird thing, man. I've been on tour before. The cable's like buggered. And I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And then you got to use it like over Bluetooth on your laptop. And there's like a delay when you're doing beeping. Yeah. That's just not the one, man.
I've never, so, yeah. I've touched wood, I've never snapped the cable yet. But my
next gig, mate,
it's going to happen in it.
Yeah, you can tune yourself out.
I need to get replacement pads though. Mine are fucked. Yeah.
There's a place on Gloucester Road actually that there's a boat shop, isn't it, on Gloucester, the bottom of Gloucester Road.
Mm.
I think they got them in stock actually.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. Or just Amazon, isn't it?
Amazon. It's fucking hell. What did we do before Amazon?
I know.
Argos. We had to go to Argos and go through the book.
That was it. The big old book. Yeah. And Woolworths and all those things.
Woolworths. It's amazing in Australia that Woolworths is still around.
There is, yeah. In Perth, there's a massive Woolworths.
Yeah. It's like their biggest like shopping centre.
They're really proud of it as well.
Yeah. All I remember in Woolworths are the pick a mix.
You used to nick them, just like.
No, I was always a good kid. I was always a good kid. Yeah. Never stole anything.
I heard you were a good kid. You know, I was chatting to you a while ago, and I said that I met someone like when I was dog walking a couple of years ago that used to babysit you.
Who was that?
I'm trying to think. Someone, Sally, maybe.
Maybe.
Because right, what happened is like, you know, just chatting to her. I'm a DJ. She's like, oh, I know a DJ. Oh, he's a babysitter called Will Clark, and he's doing really well now. He's such a good little boy. and I didn't actually know of you at that time.
Yeah.
So I googled like Bristol Will Clark and stuff like that, and then
because I'm not really a Bristol boy, although like
I'm up there on your Wikipedia.
But yeah, okay. It says Bristol because it's easy for me to explain where I live. If I try and explain where I live, no one's gonna fucking know where I live.
Yeah.
So totally. Bristol's the closest. I was never part of the Bristol crew. Were you ever part of like the Bristol crew when you were in it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Definitely. But like Die and all that lot. 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was it like?
I don't make drum and bass, innit, really?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Is like Bristol was so drum and bass.
Yeah.
So drum and bass. What was it like growing up for you in Bristol?
I mean, yeah, it was quite mad, really. I mean, when I was like around like 15 and stuff like that, when I sort of slowly started to get into things, I just remember my dad and mum and dad would like take me to house parties and stuff, just like dump me in the corner, like they couldn't be bothered to get a babysitter. So, and this is crazy, man. So I was just like this little kiddie. I just kind of started to get into making beats and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I can talk more about all that stuff later, but it was cool, man. Just so I was sort of like, I kind of witnessed the inception of things like Massive Attack when they're called the Wild Bunch. You know, I'd just be sat in the corner, me and my little brother, my parents were just getting stoned in the kitchen, you know, and then it's like Beeps or like the guy like Grant on the decks and stuff like that. I had my little Kangol hat on trying to blend in. Fucking mental, man. So yeah, it's like an interesting kind of, you know, move into bless you, into, you know, what's going on.
Yeah, I can imagine it being a very, like, especially then, because like you said, it must've been around the Massive Attack, Porter's Head kind of era. Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, no, it was way before that actually happened, really. It was, that kind of came a bit later. That was like when people, they all started to sort of do really well.
Yeah.
My era was more like Smith and Mighty.
Okay.
I'm not sure if you sort of, you was chatting to Ad Rock, weren't you?
Yeah.
You have a chat, like,
no. With who?
Adam.
Oh, yeah, Adam. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Adam from the Mad Rocks. I think that was his hip-hop name years ago.
Was that his hip-hop name?
Yeah, he stole it from the Beastie Boys, Ad Rock. Yeah, that's what I know, yeah. Totally. What's his DJ name again now?
Got Some.
Got Some, yeah. That's the kiddie.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, I watched your one talking to him, and he's sort of like, he's talking about that.
So are you guys the same era?
No, he's a bit younger than me.
Yeah, yeah.
He was really good friends with Di and all that lot, so... Yeah. He was sort of like skating with Di and going to all these kind of things. And I was always a little bit on the outside because I was just a bit more, I was a bit of a loner, to be honest, when I was here, because I was just really into making music. And I was into skating, but I wasn't that good at it. I'm tall, you know what I mean? My center of balance is a bit.
Yeah.
I had a longboard so I could cruise around.
Yeah, yeah.
I just couldn't bust, like, I couldn't do ollies, I couldn't do flip trips. I can't even say it. You know what I mean? But. I don't know, man. So I wasn't sort of like one of those kind of cool kids that was hanging out on College Green and blah, blah, blah. But I was, kind of, because I was like a rave DJ at that point. But you know what I mean?
So, I've never met Di.
Have you not?
No, I've never met him.
Mental. You should get him on, actually.
Yeah, I'd love to. Get him on. Yeah. I love his music so much. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, well, at the moment, definitely. His Watch the Ride stuff seems to be...
What's that? I've not followed any of that.
It's like it's a new project called Watch the Ride.
Yeah.
I think they got some, like, good Radio 1 support like at the moment. So
that's dope.
Yeah, man.
So yeah, I need to check that out. So let's go back. I want to go back to Bristol back in the day.
I think
people are really interested. Because Bristol's such a wild city. Because
it's got such a good reputation as well,
it's
man.
Insane reputation for what? Yeah, for
more than you realise, actually. When you actually talk to people.
I know.
Laurent Garnier was like just gushing about it the other day. Do you know what I mean?
It's and it's like, it's such an interesting city because it's a very metropolitan city. It's very, you've got like a business side of it.
Yep.
You've got a bougie side of it. You've got, you've got a pikey side of it. You've got like, you've got everything in one city, but it's also so small at the same time.
Yeah, totally.
And like, you can walk everywhere, really. Yeah. Like, it's just a city that's like a hot pot of like every different culture. You've got like huge Somalian community. You have a huge Jamaican community. You have a huge Pakistani community. And then you have like Bristolians, if you know what I mean.
Yummy lover.
Yeah. And it's just... The art that comes from it is fucking mental.
Yeah, totally, man. It's just like, I mean, I think a lot of it's down to the fact that it used to be a slave port, didn't it? The whole kind of, if you go down to like the underneath the suspension bridge on the Portland, like port, what's that name? Like motorway-ish kind of
area again?
Portway,
yeah.
There's these mad like structures that are still left there, these wooden structures. And I'm sure, you know, that was like docking places for the slave trade and stuff like that. And they just left the stuff there. It's like, it's quite creepy, really.
There's a lot of history.
Naughty history as well, isn't it? I mean, the whole Colston thing. And
it's really bad, obviously, but I think it's also what's made us today.
Yeah.
So, like
the West Indian influx, that's a lot of people say that's one of the main reasons, you know, the whole reggae influence, the bassline thing.
Exactly.
You know, it's wrong, man. That's leaked into pretty much everything that comes out of Bristol in some way or another.
Pretty much.
You know, the houseier stuff is quite, you know, kind
dubby.
Of, yeah, it pays respect to all that kind of stuff.
Well, I think for me, and this is where it kind of linked in for my career, is like like I had initially signed to Dirty Bird, and
that's when I first like heard about you. Actually.
Yeah, and that kind of came through like Eats Everything, obviously, and then Barkley from Claw Von Stroke and Justin Martin, and they were all making like drum and bass, and like the San Francisco, the relationship between San Francisco and Bristol were kind of similar, where there was like a crew in San Fran making drum and bass and house music, and then it was kind of everyone from Bristol was like making drum and bass, but also wanted to make house music, and then they were making hard style, and it just kind of like emerged into one thing.
Yeah, massively. I mean, it's completely what happens, you know. And if you look at San Fran, people like Justin Martin, I still think he's absolutely amazing.
Mm.
Oh my god, yeah,
dude, his stuff's ridiculous.
He posted the track on Instagram the other day, and I really want to get it. It's like, you know, there's something that he's just made, and he's not going to put out for about 3 years, and it's like. But, you know, we're all guilty of doing that, aren't we? We do little teasers of our own tracks that we're really happy about, and then you can imagine I'd be like, oh, I want that. Sorry, mate.
I was talking to him a couple of months ago. In fact, it's probably longer than a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
I was in San Fran and we both played a different party that night, but he's like a more of an album artist I would class now. Like he releases a lot more.
Yeah.
Like his albums are much more what Justin is.
Yeah, a lot of substance into it.
Which is mad. Can you remember his Ghettos and Gardens album?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's 10 years now.
It's mad, isn't it? It's so weird.
But yeah, he was saying that
take into account COVID.
Yeah, literally. but he was saying where he'd wrote a whole new album and then he's just like scrapped it because he's like,
that's what you said recently. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. He's just.
I mean, that's quite a fair play thing to say because I think a lot of people have done it. I think a lot of people wrote loads of material during COVID and then realized it wasn't quite, you know, because their heads were a little bit scrambled and stuff like that.
Yeah. So, how about you?
Yeah, I wrote loads of stuff that I thought was brilliant at the time. And I've had to like either revisit it or scrap it. But some things then I still think of, you know, definitely solid. But, you know, it's just. I'll shout and say, do you know Cuba Color or 16 bit Lolitas? He's one of our artists on Anjuna Deep. But he's like a genius. I mean, he's him and his partner got like a studio on a boat in Amsterdam.
Okay.
With like 10 cats on it or something like that. Like kind of proper like hermits, do you know what I mean? But high level, they got a proper SSL desk in there. They build speakers. They're both like electricians as well. So, you know, highly intelligent guys, whatever. But yeah, he was saying they wrote 400 tracks like during like lockdown. But just picked like 10 or 15 that are good.
400?
You know, so yeah, I know. It's like, come on, man.
That's like more than one a day.
Yeah, I know. That's just, he is a fast worker, though. Like, he is one of those guys that can do a track in one day. And I don't, some people can do that. They wake up in the morning and they work through the day and they finish track at the end of the day. I do in some way, and if they're absolute bombs, it's like, you motherfucker.
I can do it sometimes, but it's
really the whole thing.
Some of my biggest records have been one day or 3 hours.
Wow. I suppose when the magic just comes,
it just happens.
Yeah, you're just like touched by.
But I feel like the thing with your records are a lot more melodic and it feels like more thought's gone into them. Yeah. That's what it feels like from an outside perspective.
Yeah, just a lot of faffing around. But yeah, I think a lot of that's to do with we come from the days of everything was different technology-wise.
Yeah.
And the best thing that you had really was samplers. You know, we come from a sample culture where it was, and we didn't, you know, it wasn't like synths. There was no such thing as soft synths. You know, it was hardware synths. Mm. And you might have had one or two or three, you know, like maybe a Juno 106, an SH-101. And then like the rompers started coming in, but the sampler was the main thing.
Yeah.
And that was where the whole drum and bass vibe comes from. But that's also where we were at as well, when, you know, me by myself and then with Nick and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So we were really into like sound collage and just being really meticulous about how you use the 10 seconds or whatever that you've got in the sampler to maximum effect. So it was all about more is more. We weren't thinking in any kind of minimalistic way at all. Yeah. Because we were already limited massively.
Yeah.
By the technology. So, and that's where it was all about layering and multi and just trying to build things up and getting as complex as possible, I suppose, in a way. You know?
Yeah, I guess so. So I want to go to the start of your career stuff.
Yeah, sure, man.
Did you start as Jody Wisnoff or did you start with Nick with Way Out West?
I started as Earthman Jammin' Jay.
Yes.
You're right. I was 15, right? I was at school. I borrowed the 4-track. There's like, you know, remember 4-track?
Yeah.
So in the music department at school, they had one of those. So I was like, that's cool.
That's pretty cool that they had that.
Yeah. It's like, I went to St. Well, actually, you're not fully from Bristol. So
no.
I went to St. Anyway, St. Catharines for any people.
Yeah.
So, and I was like, blah, blah, blah. I was really a bit of a keener at school as well. I was doing pretty well. So, but I was also suddenly, I was a bit of a geek, but suddenly really into this cool music. Okay, so I had this weird sort of double vibe going on. But anyway, so yeah, I started sort of making music. Got given like a Casio CZ-1000 from a friend of my dad's when I was about around that kind of age. Like, wow, that was like, holy shit. I mean, this is a synthesizer. This is fun. Found, you wouldn't believe this, found an 808 in a drum shop. in Bristol on near Cabot. What's that? Jacobs Wells Road.
Okay. There's a music shop down there. Yeah.
£100, right?
Jesus.
Fucking AKA. I didn't even know what it was. It was like this black box with like colored buttons on it. And I heard the sound, and because I was into like Run DMC, Mantronics.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, these kind of early, you know, the Beastie Boys.
Yeah.
There's a certain kind of drum sound that they all were using, like the 808 rim shot and 808 snare and this big round bass drum. And they were like, just such weird sounds. Just the most unusual drum sound you've ever heard, but they were all using it.
And yeah.
I'm really, really, just turned me on, you know. I went from just like not really being into music to hearing this. And
thinking, yeah.
Fascinating. You know what I mean? So, and then I found the machine.
For £100 as well.
But yeah, I mean, and it was like, so yeah, I said to my dad, you know, can I borrow £100? I need this, like, give it to me. And it was like, yeah, man. So suddenly I had an 808 and I didn't even know the value of it. It's just, you know, a funny sounding beatbox.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Do you still have it?
Yeah, so my dad got it for me. So suddenly I had like a Casio keyboard, a 4-track drum machine, had one Technics, like not even a Technics deck, I had like a belt drive deck.
Yeah, yeah.
My dad's one, I just put grease paper on it so you could scratch. Because otherwise it would just, you couldn't. It's just
belt drive.
You know, that's, I think that's how a lot of people started anyway. Like, you know, just Technics were like $2,000 or $3,000.
Yeah, they were so expensive. They still are expensive.
Yeah, probably more expensive now.
So expensive now.
Yeah, man. But so that was it. I just used to, you know, just cut up like breaks and stuff on my dad's, cross the odd deck with a mixer turned to the side so the crossfader went that way.
Yeah, yeah. So were you making hip hop then?
Yeah. When I was 15, I was like getting into hip hop. That was what was kind of the thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Were you rapping as well?
I heard house and I hated it.
Really?
I remember going to, you know, stuff like hanging out, my dad taking me places. It used to be a place where they had like two decks. Dom, have you heard of Dom Thrupp?
No.
So he's a producer. They were called the Too Bad Crew at this time.
Okay, yeah.
Like Friends of Massive Attack, or they were called the Wild Bunch. And they're all like, you know, the same crew. Used to play at the Bugout, which is like a famous club in Bristol on near Park Street.
Yeah. And
anyway, that's like, that was their kind of scene then. Mm. But I clearly remember, right, I was about 15-ish, and Dom played me house music. Like, this is late 80s, and he played some Chicago house to me. I thought it was awful. I was just so disappointed. He said, listen, Jody, this is the future.
Yeah.
This is the future of dance music. And it was like, God, it was just the worst thing I'd ever heard. We had, you know, it was like a 707 kick drum and, you know, thin claps and this dodgy geezer singing and like, thin.
Yeah.
But it's probably an absolute classic, you know. It's probably like one of the.
It's probably like Frankie Knuckles or something like that.
It was, yeah. It was mine. But, you know, just a fine specimen of, you know, vintage Chicago house music. But so, yeah, so I'd experienced house at that point and really was not feeling it.
It's funny how our like tastes change over the years though, right?
I mean, really is.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think they change? Do you think it's like more like peer pressure? Not peer pressure, but like our surroundings?
I really hope. Maybe it's, I think house music improved greatly, though.
Yeah.
So that's what.
Because I didn't like drum and bass growing up. But I think it was more of like a rebellion thing because all my mates listened to it.
Yeah, so you were going against
the grain. I was just like, no, I can't listen to this shit. But it was when, like, for me growing up, it was when, like, it was Pendulum and Tarantula and all of that.
Right, yeah. And that's when drum and bass has gone all a bit weird to me, to be honest.
Yeah, and it wasn't really for me. And
I'm not surprised.
I hadn't really dug into like the jungle side of it.
Yeah, the good shit. Yeah, I bet you have that. I bet you've like gone way fucking deep.
Yeah, I love drum and bass. I love it.
Incredible. Like Midnight's drum and bass. Oh, it's called like jungle techno. Mm. And it became, you know, drum and bass at some point. But
yeah,
when it was still jungle, I mean, the early book and stuff.
So good.
Oh my god. I mean, I've got all the records here. Just
really?
Don't listen to them every day, obviously, but I can. You know, it's this constant source of, you know, inspiration, man.
So how did it go from
hip-hop
to then?
Yeah, it's, God, what? Yeah, so I suppose I put a record out. That's what kind of gave me some real confidence. And that was the hip-hop stuff.
Yeah.
That's when I was still, then it was me and my little brother, right? We were called, I stopped being called Earthman Jam and Jay because I thought that was.
You should bring that back. That's such a good name.
Di always rips me. Di still calls me Earthman. So funny. So my little brother was a rapper. He was called MCLR, MC Little Rapper. Yeah. He was only 10 at the time or 11. Yeah, so we were like making tapes at school, and
that's so good. That photo is epic.
There is it. Got my little cool hat on.
That's got to be an album cover.
No, it's not going to be an album
cover. It's got to be an album cover.
This is the one time. But yeah, I was selling them at school and, you know, sold them for like a fiver each, and it's mad. Like, probably sold like 20 or 30. Mm. Most of them were dad's friends as well. But yeah, but then Smith and Mighty, me and my dad used to sell weed to. Like, this guy, but, you know, that was, he was just like a old head, you know what I mean? And
yeah,
had people coming over and just hanging out in the kitchen. And, you know, he's a really sociable character, kind of around town. And so, yeah, he knew Smith and Mighty really well. And he gave him the tape of, like, one of his tapes. And Smith and Mighty were like, yeah, invited me and my brother into a studio, which is quite mad. And that was down in St. Paul's, a really famous spot where Fresh Four, Wishing on a Star was made.
Yeah.
Di lived there for, like, he was living there for about 4 years.
Wow.
That's where Rob and Ray were just making all their, like, classics, like, Anyone... Wishing on This Time, and it was, you know, the blueprint of the Bristol sound. This is before that got big.
Yeah.
Smith and Mighty were bigger,
but
they just never took it any further because they didn't want to, because they were just too low key. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, they were like as cool as you could get. Three Strike Records was the darn label.
Yeah, I don't know any of their stuff.
Yeah, man. I'll send you some links.
Please, man. I'd love to.
Because this is like the kind of the genesis of what became the famous Bristol sound.
Yeah.
And that all came about 5 to 10 years later than
Bristol. Oh, really?
Yeah. When, you know, Cochin and Portishead and Tricky became massive. Smith and Mighty had done all this stuff. They'd been signed to London Records. You know, they almost became famous and big, but they just didn't want it. And it just didn't work. And they just sort of chilled again and started doing drum and bass. And
it's interesting how artists do that, right? Because there's been a bunch of artists that... Yeah. For me, in my era, like, Breach was one of those. Ben Westbeach.
Yeah, totally. He was wicked, man.
Like, he's super insane producer. Like, he obviously had his, like, massive hit on Dirty Bird, actually.
Yeah, he did, didn't he?
Yeah. And then he had, like, I take it he had the opportunity. I don't know him. I've met him a couple of times, but I don't know him personally. But I take it he had the opportunity to go big and... No. He just decided not to.
That's interesting, isn't it? Maybe I think he probably calculated the risk benefit, the risk, you know, damage control. Like, if you give up too much of yourself, then life's going to change too much. You know, he seemed like quite a kind of chill guy.
Yeah.
So maybe he just thought, nah, I'm just going to dip it down a bit and
chill.
Yeah, man. Who knows?
What would you do?
I mean,
you'd go for it, wouldn't you?
The thing is, I don't want any more work than I've got at the moment. So I've suddenly got to a point where I'm perfectly happy.
You had a very fucking successful career, though.
It's been mental. I mean, in the mid, you know, we're kind of jumping around sort of time scales here. But there was a point when Way Out West were just like sort of like proper name remixes in the UK. It was bonkers, man.
I remember the first time I saw Way Out West.
Yeah.
When I was. It was at Glastonbury.
A mental one.
I came and watched you guys when I was... Fuck, I must have been 14.
Wicked. Was the beard almost as long?
Yeah, it was pretty long then.
Yeah, man.
I
really want to see you without a beard, just out of curiosity.
I'll send you a picture.
What it looks like.
I'll send you a picture. There's one floating about. I remember... And did you guys do like a DJ Mag mix? Like a CD or something.
There was an Annie Nightingale mix that did really well on Radio 1, but I don't think we did we might have done some magazine things.
It was another Way Out West something. And I remember listening to that as a kid.
There was a bonus. There was a DJ mix. It was like the bonus CD for our third album, I think.
Maybe so that was it.
Might be that.
But I remember listening to that religiously.
Dude.
Which is it's weird, right? Like how careers move on and go. But how did the Way Out West thing start?
Yeah, so that came quite a lot after the kind of Should I just quickly talk really quickly about what happened after hip hop? Because I went basically, let's do that. Hip-hop thing happened, put out a record, blah, blah, blah. Got like confidence enough to think this could actually be something. Still at school, blah, 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 blah. You know, let's sort of pottering along. And then the rave thing was kind of went from hip hop to like early house. Like, actually made a record, and first house record I made was with Die.
Yeah.
Under the name of True Funk. So we became True Funk at that point.
Okay.
Then changed my name to DJ Joey D. That's getting closer to Jody, isn't it? Yeah. So
Joey D. That sounds like the guy from what's his name?
Joey Deacon.
No, the guy from what's his name? The Jersey Shore.
That's right, that's not too bad.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still pretty bad, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, but there's a guy called like a handicapped guy called Joey Deacon who was on Tomorrow's World.
Oh, was there?
Yeah, and so I basically got the piss take out of me for calling myself Joey Deacon. So that was a bad move as well.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so that didn't stick for too long. But that, you know, that was for a minute. And that was me and Di, and my brother was in True Funk as well for a bit. Mm. But that's when we transitioned from like hip hop to house before rave. So this is 1991.
Yeah.
No, 1990, sorry. And we put out a record called 4 AM.
Yeah.
Was mental. So we went to, it was like a bit of a copy of 808 Pacific State kind of thing. That was the template at that point. You know, guy called Gerald, Voodoo, Warp Records, all those kind of early UK kind of minimal English techno. That had bass lines creeping in, but were still, you know, like the English before breaks. This is like when it was still more formal chemical. But yeah, so we made this track called 4 AM. Which is mental. So we went to London with Smith & Mighty and Di came along and Peter B. Rose, do you know?
No,
you
heard I don't.
Of like, he's like more rockers.
Okay, yeah,
that's his current bass name. So he was part of that as well. So we all like bombed up to Psalm West Studios.
Yeah.
Like a proper SSL. So my mind was blown. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. You know, going to make a proper record in a real studio. So took along my 808, like Casio keyboard, went out there, properly made a record.
I love that it's a day out.
Yeah, it was a night as well.
Yeah, I love that it's like, night. I love that that's what it used to be like, where you would like...
Yeah, it was probably, yeah. We got on the train, we went down to Temple Meads and literally got on the train to London. There's like a nice day out to go to a studio. It's fucking wicked.
Whereas like now we just literally open our laptops and it's like, fucking here we go. Got a whole studio.
Even if you're collabing with someone, you pretty much don't generally actually work with them, do you?
Do you like that? I don't like doing that.
I've never done it apart from with Nick, who I was obviously doing it with all the time. I've never collabed with someone in the flesh.
Have you not?
No, apart from Nick, like, as I said, so.
Nearly all my collabs that I've released.
That's
actually a lie, thinking about it now. But most of them, I've done something in the flesh with them.
Wicked. I think that's the best way to do it.
I can't.
Right. You want to get on an energy level with someone.
Yeah. Even if I don't mind traveling, I'd drive somewhere. I'd fly somewhere if I have to, because I'm just like.
Yeah, man.
For me, like making music so personable.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't want to write a record that, like, when we're in two different rooms, we're completely two different vibes. Like that person, for me, like that person might have had a shitty morning.
Yeah.
And like, I might have had the best morning of my life and I'm going in.
It's really true, actually.
Yeah. It's really important to me to like get in a vibe with people.
Similar thing with doing guest vocals as well, which is an issue, you know, because I used to always have the singer come to the studio and we'd do it together. But lately, I'd say the past 10, 15 years, it's just been sending them a track. And
really?
And then they work on it, or you send it to like 10 different vocalists and then you pick out the best one, you know? And then obviously you can work together again, but it's just the practicalities of what we do and being away most weekends and traveling a shitload and blah, 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 you know?
And having family and what needing to be more like efficient.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, there's so much to do in life, right? And so.
It's funny that I just had a podcast right before this. And we were literally talking about that same thing of like how
we juggle so much, man.
We're juggling so much, and realistically, for me, I don't know about you, but like music takes making music takes a massive backseat sometimes.
Yeah,
and
it shouldn't. No, it should be at the forefront.
Yeah.
But you literally, sometimes you've got to slip it in when you get a moment. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, which is, I'm trying to change that. trying to change that.
I mean, luckily you haven't got loads of kids yet and stuff, so
luckily. I don't plan to have kids personally as well, so that's the one thing.
It's not up to you, mate. It's up to the woman who you will meet, who will say, I want little Wills. There's no fucking choice in the matter.
Yeah, I guess so. They always win, don't they? Fucking women. Yeah, love them to bits.
It's fucking awesome having kids, though. Like, I've got a 13-year-old girl, 10-year-old boy. It's just vibes. It really is interesting.
Yeah, I've got niece and nephews, and they're great for
hand them back for
an hour. They're great, and then they can piss off back.
You're super young, though, mate. You know, you're not supposed to be understanding.
I don't know. I'm not that young now. I'm 32 now.
Like, actually, yeah, true. Like, when I was 35, that's when we had our first. Yeah, she got pregnant when I was 35. So, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of my mates have got kids as well. A lot, like, or having like second kids, and like,
a
lot of them. I'm still just this.
Yeah, but you bounce around where you live, don't you? You live in Detroit for half.
That's the tough thing. I think
you were there.
Yeah, like having a relationship. How did you find that? I know we're going around all over the place, but like,
This is the most incoherent.
It doesn't matter.
But it's all right.
But like, when you met your wife or your girlfriend, like, how was that with the whole touring thing?
I mean, so it was actually in the year 2000. So we've been together for like 22 years. So
damn.
Yeah. Congrats. I mean, she used to come to a lot of events.
Yeah.
It's South American now, don't I? but it's always a tricky one. Yeah. Definitely. There's trust issues, there's jealousy, there's missing each other, there's all sorts of things. Mm. Really quite hard.
Yeah. Cause that's the thing, is we're always away, right?
Yeah, man. Yeah. I mean, it's quite intense, really. And then if you've got like kids as well, you just kind of feel a bit of guilt for being away.
Yeah.
But then you balance it up with the fact that when you're at home, you're there, you're more present
all the time. Yeah.
You know, we're there for them, instead of being like a guy that goes to the office in the morning and comes back moody and knackered in the evening. You know, we come back on a Monday or Tuesday, buzzing, really happy because we've just been rocking it. And then you're giving them, you know, good energy, I suppose. Yeah. So I think it balances out more in that direction.
That makes sense.
Conventional dude who's got a job we might like but might not like.
And realistically, we can choose our own schedule if we really want.
Yeah, totally, mate. Like, so how are you, like, do you, like, schedule wise do you take weekends off or at the moment, or are you just letting it all?
I don't take holidays. I don't go away on holiday. And I don't really take weekends off.
Where do you live again?
I live near Cheddar.
Cheddar, that's a bit of a holiday anyways. Yeah,
it's pretty beautiful here.
Good cheese.
Solid cheese, mate. Solid cheese. But like, say for instance, when this podcast is out, next week isn't next week, but as of next week, I'm taking 2 weeks out to write.
Okay, fair enough.
So I'm doing 2 weeks in London just writing with loads of people.
Wicked.
That I don't really take time off, to be fair.
Yeah, man.
I don't. Were you ever like that?
No, I was like always not having enough gigs.
Yeah.
And like having time off, not wanting it, you know, up until like the last 2 or 3 years, really.
Mm.
And just recently, it's like, it's just gone
mental.
You know, it's brilliant. It's like, it's, you know, when the Way Out West thing was big, obviously I was more into like remixing and stuff, so I didn't need to be DJing, and the fees were really good back in the day
because
the internet didn't exist and people were selling records.
Yeah.
So that was a different thing. But, you know, sort of a bit further on, when there was definitely a time period where it was, you know, we were all struggling, I think.
Mm. Yeah,
a lot of people that had been either quite big at one point and then it dips. There was like a kind of a recession, a dance music recession. Definitely.
Well, I think it's happened now with COVID. I think what's happened now is that people that had success before COVID and kind of, I have my theories of reasons why, but coming out of COVID aren't as successful. It's kind of the similar situation. And then there's people that are a lot more successful now that were before COVID nothing. And I think that's just the way the industry goes, right? Some people have their time, some people don't have their time. You had your Way Out West type days and it was solid, and then that dips. We all have peaks and troughs. We can't always be at the fucking top.
Yeah, but some people might just have a peak and then it goes that down, you know, and then it's, you're quite lucky to go up again sometimes, I think. That's the kind of, you know, that's the risky thing about having, well, especially if you have too much success too quickly. It must be quite hard to like maintain that if you have like a massively big record.
Yeah,
you don't make the right moves to follow up. I think that's that thing. Sorry, about.
Yeah, I think it's I don't know. I've never experienced it because I've never had a record. I've never had a hit record.
Never have a hit record. It'll ruin you.
Yeah, this is the thing. Is like
you're constantly trying to make something bigger and better, and you just become so self-critical, and it'll just be harsh.
But do you not find that yourself now, just generally?
What being self-critical and stuff?
You'll have one record, and then you're like, well, it didn't do as well as that record.
I don't care how well things do. Because I've never made music with the intention of it selling. I know it sounds weird, but it's not my motivation. I don't check really to, because you know, once something's out anyway, and if you copy it, then you're sheep, aren't you, really? I gauge sort of the success level in more of a kind of a slow burn, really, as opposed to like kind of trying to jump in there and like bump it up. Do you know what I mean? It's quite hard to explain, but
try and explain. I think people need to hear this.
You know, like, I think, so for example, like, you know, I've put out a few of the singles under my own name, like I say The Bridge, Star Strings, Cold Drink Hot Girl. You know, I kind of, they were like, I think they were big, but they were never massive, but they were big enough to just keep things, the accumulative effects, I think, in a way, of just putting out records that kind of have a bit of a sort of, you know, I'm not being arrogant, but a bit of a timeless quality, like they kind of sound good now, and it, well, they, you know, they sound as good in a way as they did
when they 10 got, years ago.
Like the musical integrity and the fact that they're not focused on a certain, you know, like time of fashion will sound at that time, kind of thing. I think that's my kind of strategy, really, just to keep it kind of smooth and
timeless music.
Yeah, I suppose.
I guess over the years you've seen everything go up and down, right?
I've seen progressive house go so out of fashion, it's untrue.
And now it's fashionable again.
Yeah, it's a horrible term, and the stuff that is sold as progressive house isn't really what it is. But it's, I think that's what they call, is it melodic techno now?
Mate, whatever they're putting out as melodic techno is definitely trance, if you ask me. I think you're onto something there where you said like you're just putting out, trying to make timeless records, because releasing a record that isn't fitting in a lane or in a sound or on a, for a certain label or for whatever reason, like for a commercial success. And I mean commercial success in any way, like it doesn't have to be a fucking hit. I mean commercial success meaning you're going to make money out of it because it's on something that's popular. It's really interesting. Like, because I think
hiring for your small business, if you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
if you can stick to something, if you can stick to a sound, or you can evolve your sound into something that you love and you can stand by for the whole of your career.
Yeah. Keep the same name. This is quite an unusual thing to do.
Yeah.
And not many people can get away with that. Like, I think a lot of people change they come up with like a pseudonym or, you know, an alternative ego to accommodate this slightly different sound that they're doing.
Mm.
And for some really weird reason, I've managed to not have to do that. So I can do different stuff. You know, I can go really heavy on the break stuff.
Yeah.
Just do that for, you know, a while and then go back to the 4/4 stuff. And, you know, then, and it all seems for some weird reason to be acceptable under my own name as opposed to.
Why do you think that is?
I'm not sure. Maybe it's just because I've been doing it for so long and it's just the general accumulative effect of stuff I did with Way Out West as well, maybe.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure, really. Maybe I'm just flagging it. Who knows, mate?
I think it's really interesting, though, because you've obviously seen it through the years as well, is because you've had such a healthy career and a long career in music, is that you gain fans that don't necessarily even know your old stuff.
Yeah.
And like,
that's really nice when that happens as well.
Like, how many of your new fans actually know Way Out West? And I don't mean that in a disrespectful way.
I'd say maybe 10%.
Exactly, which is fucking mental.
Yeah, totally is.
Because
I said another thing that's amazing as well is when people don't know who you are sometimes, and like, you know, they kind of, or they don't. If you're in a club and they don't know you're the DJ or something like that, then they still like it, and they're not doing it just because.
Yeah.
They're there for that reason. I'm sure that happens to you as well sometimes, where, you know, it's kind of like, it's just what you're actually doing carries the weight, not the reputation of your name and what you've done in the past.
It's great that. That's
a very good feeling.
Well, it happened to me with Nick during COVID. I was at the True Valley Lakes with I don't know if you've been out there with the, who is it? Who does the big spider at Glastonbury?
What are they called again? I know exactly what you mean. The one you can stand underneath,
Arcadia. Sure. Yeah. So they have these like trucks near True Valley Lakes where they've like turned into campsites.
Yes.
And I was there with Ed. Ed and all of that, and he had a bit of a party there.
Nice.
And I was sat on the sofa, just talking to this dude, like. We were literally just talking, like, we both didn't have a clue who each other were.
Oh, nice.
and it was Nick, and I was like, fuck me, it's Nick. And it's just amazing how you can talk to somebody and not have, like, you're not going in going, oh, this is Nick from Way Out West, isn't it?
Yeah, there's no preconception, is there?
Yeah,
there's no fanboying or anything like that.
No, it's nothing.
Yeah, that's the good shit, though, when it's like that.
And I think we can come across that in the clubs as well, when we're meeting people, right? People don't know who I am. That's the most important thing for me. I don't know about you, but when I go into a club, I go into the club thinking nobody knows who I am, and I have to win them over.
Yeah, completely, mate. That's the best mentality, because then you're kind of, you're crispy. Do you know what I mean? You're not complacent. You know, you're there to communicate with people and just... A similar thing. I think it's really important to make the crowd feel comfortable in your presence.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, so you have to kind of give them body language that makes them feel that you're chill,
okay,
and then they give it back to you. And if it's off in either way, then, you know, it can be a tricky one, can't it?
Yeah, totally.
So much down to like psychology, I think, when it comes to making a room feel comfortable and just getting on the same level as them.
Yeah, I agree. It's not all about just turning up and playing the biggest smashes.
I mean, most of it's about the music, but I think there's definitely, and that's something that you learn through experience,
totally.
That's something that people that just suddenly have a hit record when they're young, they've got to DJ, you know, blah, 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 and that's the tricky one.
Yeah.
You know, this only comes with time.
Totally.
You can't teach this shit, I don't think.
No, I totally agree. Okay, let's go back a little bit.
We're going all over the shop.
Let's go back to, so...
Yes. So we talked about the 4 a.m. thing, and started doing rave music, basically. Yeah. So that was Sublove, right? Which was, that was me and Di and a few other people occasionally. I was working in Replay Records at that point.
Yeah.
Do you remember Replay?
Yeah, I remember Replay.
Yeah. And then I got the sack because I was really bad at selling anything that wasn't raves. Yeah, I was the worst, most unemployable record salesman in the world. So bad.
Why?
Like, people come in and try to buy like Jamiroquai and things like that. And I was like, nah, you don't want that. You want this. So I was like playing them the new Top Buzz track, you know? And like, yeah. It was like, oh, I was unemployable, basically.
Replay was an institution in Bristol. But
yeah, it was good shit, man. Yeah, it was like one, the time when it was not on Park Street. This is beforehand when it was by the bus station.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm in the underpass.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so just kind of, this is like the, when 1991,
yeah,
where rave just became
blew up.
Massive. Yeah. I mean, the top 10 was just so full of, you know, Shades of Rhythm at number one, you know, Bizarre Inc. It was just Shut Up and Dance got to number one with that Raving on Raving track. And then obviously it had a massive Mark Bolan sample, and it was just mad times, man. It's like, and we were just going to free parties and places like Oxford and Great Mills Warehouse and Stroud. And it's just, yeah, it's pretty wild.
Were there many free parties around Bristol area?
Yeah, quite a lot. Yeah. In the kind of southwest, and there's things in Port Reed and stuff like that. It's crazy, man. That was just a case of turning up and just waiting around trying to get on the decks.
Yeah.
And then you'd be like waiting for like 3 hours, and then Easy Groove would just come in and just smash you out of the way and jump on and hit you in the face. And so, yeah, you had that like crazy gangster element going on as well.
Well, it was always like a little bit embedded in the underground, in like the like.
Yeah,
the drug dealers all ran it.
I mean, it all evolved into crack as well, didn't it, really? I think that's when it started to get a bit menacing.
You could really hear
like the change in the music as well.
Yeah.
It became quite dark side, and that was either like maybe a come down of the euphoria of like 91 and 92.
Yeah.
But the music just suddenly in 1993, it like with Reinforced Records and Moving Shadow. It got really, really like trippy and dark, and I loved it at the time. You know, like Top Buzz, Basement Records. That was a fine example of the darkness. Have you checked much old Basement Records stuff?
No, I haven't.
Man, I need to like turn you on to.
Yeah, please do.
Because it was this guy called Jack Smooth, Ron Wells is his name. He's still doing stuff at the moment.
Yeah,
he looked like their producer. It was all 4/4, right?
Yeah.
So it's like 4/4 kick drum. With breaks in the back, just kind of rolling along, but loads of really nice, like, sort of washy pads and synths, and really good, like, techie kind of stabs.
Mm.
Very distinctive sound, and this was, like, jungle techno.
Okay.
So it was in between, thing and heading towards house and techno kind of thing. And it was a really unique, like, time, man. Like, I'll have to send you some links to stuff.
So was that past the ecstasy time? And
yeah, this is where the ecstasy thing was just maybe starting to saturate a bit. Yeah, and the collective come down was maybe, but it's still euphoria going on, but there's the dark side coming in a little bit,
and crack was getting involved.
Yeah, and that was jungle, man. Like when crack really came in, it was just like booyaka charge, you know what I mean? It got really fucking dodge. This is where my journey veered into meeting Nick Warren, and this is the beginning of Out West. It was like a big change, really. It was like 93, and you were either going in that direction, or this house scene suddenly started to seem like so much nicer. You know, you go to house clubs, and it just felt safe. Do you know what I mean?
And well, the jungle and the drum and bass scene for me has always had the darker side to it, always. Like, especially growing, because I'm like 10 years later from you. So growing up, like, with and having to go to drum and bass parties because all my mates go to drum and bass parties.
Yeah.
And it was always like,
a bit more chavvy.
More chavvy, really.
And it was annoying growing up with that, actually.
Yeah, and it was
your heyday of like.
Yeah, it was. And that's one of the reasons why I wasn't into it. Because I'm like.
Yeah, you get that, yeah.
It was like every MC trying to out MC everybody else, and it was just like not that. It wasn't for me at all.
Yeah, I can feel that, mate. I can feel that. Yeah, that must have been a bit of a. I bet you were glad when you found something that came along that was much more of a street.
Yeah, definitely.
What were you playing then at first? Then what really turned you on? That really sort of latched onto. At
time. Soulful House, like Frankie Knuckles. Yeah,
right, that was stuff I hated.
Yeah, that was like classic Defected was like what I started playing.
Got it, okay.
The first like the first dance record was like Scooter, right? It was like hard style. Like my brother bought like Dance 95. It was like a Dance Mania 95 CD.
Yeah, this is Dance 95.
Yeah. It was like Scooter, Move Your Ass and like that. But Faithless was huge. Is huge in my life. Like they were, Faithless, Chemical Brothers, Faithless, Fatboy Slim.
I'm jumping forward a little bit, but we toured with Faithless in 2004.
Really?
It was way out west. Yeah, it was wicked, man. For 2 months, we did 1 month in Australia and 1 month in America.
Amazing.
The American one wasn't with Faithless. It was just way out west on the tour.
How was that?
Really, it was cool, man. Yeah, it's we were like the support acts, obviously.
Yeah.
I remember the last night of the tour. I think it was Max's birthday or something.
Yeah.
Or it might be Nick's birthday actually. But we were all in like one hotel room, just carrying on and stuff like that. And it all got a little bit messy. And I to do Truth or Dare stuff. And my dare was I had to run down the corridor of the hotel with nothing but one sock on my right foot. And it was recorded. And I found the old video, the tape.
Yeah.
It was like the handy cams. I found it the other day.
No way.
I was thinking as well, did this actually happen or was it just a weird memory that I've created?
Yeah.
Just being a complete nutter, and it did. And it's like, yeah, I can hear all the Faithless backing singers laughing and stuff like that. And
that's so good.
What's that? Not putting that on YouTube.
Faithless for me. I went to the, when I think I was 12 when I went to see them first.
Yeah, man. Maxi's voice is so good.
Maxi's just a G, man.
I'd love to meet him as well. He seems like just such as like chilled out Buddhagree kind of.
I don't think he's that well. I heard the other day, I don't think he's that well.
No.
Yeah, I could be wrong, but somebody told me the other day that he's not doing too well, which isn't good. But he's got to be kicking on.
I mean, it's just the Blissey's not that young as well. They're all in their 60s.
Yeah.
Everyone, like, that, even like Pete Tong, Westwood.
Yeah.
Can't talk about Westwood
now, mate. Yeah.
But Carl Cox, the Ox at Rocks, they're all, everyone's in their 60s.
I saw, I played Movement a couple of weekends ago, and amazing, man. Amazing. It's the first time I played, but I've been going for like years.
Yeah, man.
But I saw a picture of Jeff Mills, and I was like, damn, he's an old man. And like,
was he there though? Was he actually?
Yeah, he played. Yeah, he closed out.
But I remember him. Yeah, how's he doing? Is he still
amazing?
Pretty fast music.
Yeah, it's amazing. I love Jeff Mills. That's just fucking amazing. Jeff Mills and Carl Craig.
Saw him at La Cosa years ago. Yeah. And he's playing like 2 minutes of each record.
Smash. Yeah.
Chucking it over his shoulder, putting another one.
Yeah.
Incredible, man.
Yeah, it's fucking amazing.
Was he good though? Did he look well and stuff like that?
He looks old, and I don't mean this in a horrible way. Like, I don't want anyone to be like offended by this, but like, he's an old man, and it's actually like kind of, it made me realize it's we're coming to that time where house music has been born, and in like the 80s, and now
it's almost had one life cycle, hasn't it?
Almost. We're nearly at, obviously we've lost a lot of people in house music already, due to old age now it's like the old age is kind of going to be happening in the next 10, 15 years. And you're like, it's scary.
It is really weird, dude. Yeah. But
it also makes it realize how young house music is.
Yeah, completely. Because you look at all jazz and stuff and you think of most jazz musicians as old guys on front covers of albums, Or the funk guys, all these old like record sleeves.
But then if you think about it, like how young music actually is, not music, but like recorded music, like Aretha Franklin, right? Like she died a few years ago, but like how old was like she's been doing it for years. And I don't know when the first recording was.
The first actual meet of going into the studio, they used to cut directly to vinyl, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The band would go in, or the singer, and it would be like literally, the laser was there. It's mad, isn't it?
So you know Jack White?
Yeah, yeah.
Have you been to any of his record shops called Third Man Records?
No.
So
actually, Jack White, are you talking about?
Sorry?
Which Jack White is this?
Jack White from the White Stripes.
Yeah.
So he has a record label called Third Man Records, and has two record shops, one in Nashville, one in Detroit.
Okay.
And his one in Detroit has a record pressing plant behind the shop. So you can go into the shop and watch all of the records being pressed. It's fucking amazing. And they do this live series where they have a band on stage and then they record it directly to vinyl.
It's a needle. Yeah. That's mad.
But it's pretty special that they do that.
Yeah. That's such an original way of working, isn't it?
Yeah, because you can't go back on it. And
you've got to get it right. Yeah. Mm. I mean, if you want to do another lacquer afterwards, it's going to cost about 100 more quid.
But it's to a live studio. It's to a live audience. So it's just like, it's straight up.
Double live, isn't it?
Yeah.
Properly.
Yeah, I love it.
That's what musicians are good at, you know?
I guess we're just in such a young industry.
Yeah, that's nice, isn't it, really?
Yeah, special.
Yeah. I mean, it's what kind of, you know, we're lucky, mate. We're lucky that kind of things like this actually happen. You know, you look at the world in general, and you know, there's many, I'd say probably more of planet Earth, people have not got creative industries that are based on, you know, pleasure and the stimulation of hearing. I mean, this is, you know, you can have a bad day and anything, actually.
We're so lucky, man. We're so lucky. And to be fair, like, if you think of how many people in electronic music, dance music, how many people are actually doing it as a career?
Mad. It's mental. Yeah. I mean, it's very, very unusual, especially in this, you know, people coming through now to actually just not have a job, to be doing it only the only thing.
Yeah.
That makes it double lucky.
It's crazy. Have you always done music as a career, or have you had other jobs during that?
Apart from working in a record shop, no. Yeah. I've been quite fortunate, actually.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yes, weird, actually, if you think about it. But I think it's just not having a plan B in some ways. And I remember, like, I dropped out of A-levels at school, did like 1 year, and then left. And my dad was like, that's a really bad move. You better be making some money within a year, or you're going back into education, boy. And I was like, right, okay, shit. But it's just odd, man. It's just, for some reason, things have just
worked out
okay enough to, you know, keep rolling. And, you know, as I said, there's been down periods, and then at the moment it's just, you know, nice. Maybe it'll go down again, but then hopefully it'll go up. So it's cool, man. Just ride it out, isn't it?
I guess that's the thing, you never know, which is kind of the beautiful thing about this industry, right?
Yeah, man. Definitely.
So back to Nick Warren.
Yes. Oh God. Yeah. We're 93 now.
93. We've got fucking 20 years to get to.
Oh God. Yeah, how long have we got?
30 years, actually, thinking about it.
Mental. So yeah. So that was interesting. It was like, another friend of my dad's, basically, was Nick, and he suggested we work together. And Nick came over and he had a sampler as well. So I had like one Akai S1000. He had one as well. So suddenly we had two Akai S1000s, and that gives you like 20 outputs.
Yeah.
So we had 20 outputs going into the desk instead of 10. So it was like, we'd like doubled our power, you know, joined forces. And it was nice, man. Like, he just came in with different style of beat.
Yeah.
He was like, kind of, it was all just like really Balearic stuff, you know, just samples of just a different sound. Because he was really into the Italo house and, you know, a lot of the kind of Spanish stuff, and this is, and then Progressive House was just coming in, like Guerrilla Records, and this, you know, this whole side of things. And it was just, to me, it was so inspiring, and it's such a fresh sound, because I'm so engrossed in like breakbeats and rave stuff for like the past sort of 3 years. And it just felt like a sort of like an energy shift. It was just slower, but it felt faster in a weird way, because the grooves just kind of felt like, in some ways, if you slow down the BPM, you can get like more into it. The 16ths aren't as squashed together.
So
it's just, you know, I was finding it quite a nice kind of refreshing thing. So I came in, but I came in with my kind of breakbeat head and my rave head and my that kind of soundscape. And then Nick comes in with his Balearic thing, but also really into like film soundtracks, you know. He's just like really into. He's a heavy crate digger.
Okay.
Amazing, you know. So he record collection was just ridiculous. And he'd always be, because he was a massive DJ at that point as well, supporting Massive Attack and Resident of Cream. And, you know, he was like
the one.
One of the top 10 in England. He was in the, he was a superstar DJ. Here we go. Johnny was out there. And he's traveling a shitload, record shopping every weekend in different parts of the world, coming back with the dopest sounds, you know? So it was cool, man, to be collabing with a proper hardcore crate digger.
Yeah.
You know, we started to like sort of delve in like that, really.
And then going from starting out to then having a pretty fucking successful career is way out west.
Yeah, we just had some, a few records. So Ajari was our first sort of big one. And then The Gift is the one that kind of opened doors, I suppose. Yeah. And that was Top of the Pops and all that stuff.
What was that? Well, like, what changed in your life, though? Like, this is what I wanted. Like, when that came out, like, did you notice a complete change from, like, was it day and night?
No, mate, it's hard. I can't really remember, actually. I just was so... When you're 21, your head's just different, isn't it? And I actually, weirdly, I was quite... I felt that I kind of... I just felt like it was what was meant to happen for some reason. Because if you're making music all day, every day, I was just so trapped in this world of what was going on.
Mm.
It wasn't like, wow, this has happened, because I knew the music was pretty dope.
Yeah.
We, you know, with Nick on my side, we were, and Pete Tong was pushing it, and we were the Deconstruction Records. So it was just a lot of things like positively affirming what we were doing.
21's so, young.
Yeah, yeah. And it's quite a young to get.
Super young.
Quite a young. So can't even talk properly. But yeah, it was quite mad, man, to suddenly be on Top of the Pops at like 21-ish. No, was it? Wait a minute. 16. Oh, I can't remember. It was before. It was below
30, anyway. Yeah. But if you think about it, like, that was the amazing thing about British culture and British music then, is that you could be on Top of the Pops with an underground record, really.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. It was, I mean, I'd actually was really inspired by like some chords I heard. There's a club, do you remember the club called, have you ever heard of Rage? No, not Rage. It was in Shepton, in Milton Keynes.
Okay.
What was the famous rave club in Milton Keynes? Was that Rage or was that
a
London?
Remember. I don't remember. I was around.
Fabian Groovrider were playing, and there's this one track that just stuck in my mind. Like the chords were the same chords from The Gift.
Yeah.
So it's actually plagiarism. Like, and we have obviously paid royalties, but I thought that one day I'm going to use those chords, and it's fucking identical. It's the same four chords with like a little plinky piano. Like, boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, sneaky. Well, I didn't tell anyone at the time, but. Did have to declare it. So, don't riff off of a rave classic. Crazy days, man.
Yeah, man.
But yeah, I mean, I suppose the big change that happened, the sort of like just in a practical sense, was that I was making more money because we started offered loads and loads and loads of remixes.
Yeah,
like more than I could handle.
So was that then when you were like, were you gigging more as well as way out west?
Not. I was DJing a bit. Nick was DJing all the time. He was like every weekend.
So was he just going out as Way Out West, or was he going out as Nick Warren?
He's always DJing on his own name.
Okay.
So yeah, as Nick Warren. So Nick was doing that. I was starting, so around 95, this is when it was all sort of like, 96 was when The Gift came out and stuff. I was really into techno at this time, like IQ Records, an English hard house kind of sound, like Hard Hands. And I didn't like handbag housey stuff at all. I was definitely into the higher BPM kind of stuff. So when I was DJing, that was kind of stuff I was playing, you know, like Sven Dates early stuff. And but so started first America shows started to come through then. So I had like an agent in New York. They had like Carl Cox in the books at that time, it was quite mad, with Hands on Deck.
Okay.
So that was like I got into the American scene really quite early on.
Yeah, super early.
I played at Twilo when it was still open.
Wow.
So that was probably one of my first gigs in the States, and 10-15 Folsom in San Fran.
Still going.
There. It is, isn't it? It's mental, isn't it?
Still going.
Bars in Washington, played there for like the Millennium. That was quite mad. So yeah, I was kind of really lucky to start getting international gigs. And I remember chatting to Nick around that time, and we were talking about playing in America, and we were saying to each other, yeah, let's just make the most of this, because, you know, soon they'll realize that they don't have to book internationals. They can get their own DJs. But at that point, we're like, wow, that might happen at some point. But at the moment, you know, we're loving it.
Make the most of it.
So, you know, that was really interesting, man, just suddenly getting gigs abroad.
What was it like traveling back then?
yeah, it's so different. You know, there was, I don't think there was laptops, was there?
No.
I don't think there was the internet. The internet was like 97 or something. Yeah. 95.
Yeah, but like the internet wasn't really anything until like 2000s.
Yeah. It wasn't, was it? Yeah. Traveling was odd. Do you know, the weird thing is I can't actually remember a single flight.
Really?
Nothing in my memory. And obviously they were shit because you'd just be on the plane and there'd be nothing. One screen up there. I probably had a middle seat, you know, it was like, just wasn't used to it at all. Probably had a headache. You know, it's crazy, man.
Yeah, so that's mad. I had
discovered, like, you know, the joys of red wine and flying and feeling mellow. You know, got my head into the right mindset. But, yeah, but then again, it was really exciting. So it was also, it was just new, wasn't it? Mm. So it felt like it was just kind of, it was just like, kind of an adventure, I suppose.
Totally. And it's what you always wanted to do, right? And I think for me is like, I don't know if you can relate, but when you start touring and you start doing something that you've always wanted to do and realistically never thought it could happen, and then it happens.
It's mad.
And you're like, fuck, it happened.
It's actually quite interesting, man, when it actually becomes reliable as well and not just, you know, saying, oh, I've blagged another gig. I'm sure that's what it must be like for pretty much everyone. It's like, yeah, I've got a gig. And then the gig's over, oh, no, hopefully I'll get another gig. And, you know.
Well, it's the little wins, isn't it? When you're first starting, it's like, and you sit, like, it's cringeworthy at the time, but, like, it's always a little win to you. When your track charts on some shit, download site, and you're like, oh my god, yes,
little victories, isn't it?
It's little victories,
it blows your mind because it's like, wait a minute, you know, I never thought, you know, this has actually happened. It's for real.
It's pretty mental. Yeah. It's mental. I think that's when you know there comes points in, I don't know for you, but for me, like, there comes points where sometimes I have to like sit back and be like, Jesus Christ, I still can't believe I'm doing this.
Yeah, pinch yourself moments, yeah.
Because
yeah.
It's I like...
a really big gig sometimes as well, where it's just like, you know, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Just, you know, give yourself a little nip.
Yeah, it's mental.
Like things like first time you do Mirage in Brooklyn, things like that. It's just like, wait a minute.
Yeah, they're mad. They're mad. So who did you remix as Way Out West?
Way Out West, God. Well, actually, let's have a little thing. I actually had to...
Did you make some notes?
No, I'm just Googling myself. Yeah. So that's Art of Noise, Sasha, M People, Real to Real, Faithless, Dubstar, Saint Etienne, Express 2, Freak Power, Ronnie Size, Your, Paul Van Dyke, Natalie and Rulia, Opus 3, Orbital, Inner City, Good Life.
That was
true. Good Life, these Castle Brown, Games Hold, Coaching, BC, Yesterday, Sunscreen. That's just a few of them.
That's amazing. So
it was busy, man. It's busy times, man.
I had Kevin Saunderson on the podcast.
I watched that one. Yeah. Then I felt guilty because we were one of the many people that remixed his track.
Yeah.
I'm quite proud of the remix. It was full on breakbeats though. Like if you ever check our remix of Good Life, it's like, it's that kind of highly melodic breaksy thing.
Yeah. No, yeah. The remix days were good days. I was actually talking to my parents about it last night.
Yeah.
And our remixes were literally kind of ran the industry for a period.
Yeah.
And where as artists you could actually earn really fucking good money from it.
It was really weird, man, because the budgets were just huge with the record labels, you know. Have you seen what's that film again? Kill Your Friends?
No, I haven't seen that.
It's based on the music scene in a certain point in time that was like where the budgets were really hefty and A&R were just given for every record that did well, there's loads that didn't do well. And the ones that did do well funded
everything.
Yeah, funded all these passion.
Yeah.
But there was just all this money being chucked around for remixes.
It's still the case.
Yeah, I mean it can still be busy.
But like not in different situations, right? Like all the major record labels have artist that's bankrolling the whole fucking label
completely, mate. Yeah, completely. So and that can be, you know, which is quite a nice thing in a way.
Yeah, it's pretty mad. Yeah. So then going from Way Out West days to Jody Wistanoff days,
Actually, this is one thing that's really funny that's sunny memories I've got to tell you about. This is the Way Out West days, and I still feel really bad about this.
Is this your apology for it?
Yeah, this is an official apology.
Official apology.
Yeah. So we went to, have you heard of Box Studios in Bath?
Yeah.
Peter Gabriel's.
Yeah.
Real World.
Yeah, Real World.
It's in Box, that's the area. And so it
beautiful
was,
studios.
Yeah, dope. Probably amazing.
Yeah.
So we were basically, there was an offer to work with Bernard Sumner, mm-hmm. as in the order, and a band called Electronic. Mm-hmm. So it's him and Johnny Marr, you know, the famous guitar player.
Yeah.
And what's it called again? Not Africa by Barter. Arthur Baker.
Okay, wow.
The guy who made Planet Rock. So it's Arthur Baker as a producer. Johnny Marr is the, and then Bernard is the vocalist. New Order, yeah. And I heard the track. Me and Nick went out from my dad. My dad was managing us as well for this time. So we were, all three of us there in the studio listening to this track. And I was just shaking my head. Like Bernard's voice was, I just thought it was so shit. But like, because I was never really into New Order. Like, obviously, I'm fully aware of Blue Monday being fantastic and stuff, but I just couldn't vibe on his voice. Mm. I just sat there just shaking my head in this like super posh studio, like, and it's Arthur Baker, Johnny Marr, like, was from the Smiths or something, like one of the best guitar player in the world, you know, and he was there, and Bernard was there, and Nick was just looking at me like, have I fucking lost my mind? I was just saying, no, can't work with this. And then it was so fucking, and I was just, that was when my head was a bit odd, I think. Like, yeah. I was just weird, like, vibe.
What do you think that was? Was that the ego period?
I was just inundated with remix offers, you know, and like just other things I thought sounded better. Like, I think I was remixing Outlander Vamp. Do you remember that?
No, I don't. Dun, 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 like a
I never finished anyway for some reason. I think I went to Dastardly instead, just had them. But there's so many like good offers that I just. Yeah. I just didn't like the sound of his voice. Mm. And then we had to go for a walk in the woods and talk about it. And it's so odd, man. And Nick was just like, I don't think he's ever forgiven me. Just for the actual kudos of working with them. And I think it was a co-production offer, you know? And I was like, no. Nah. So.
Jesus.
Boy. I know.
We've all had it.
A bit out of key, though. So this is before.
Well, at the end of the day, like, if you're not feeling it, you're not feeling it.
Yeah, I know, mate. But, you know, made up for it. Like, Trevor Horn from Art of Noise, like he came down to the studio. That was a nice vibe.
Yeah.
He was a lovely bloke as well, so he was really sweet.
Did you ever work in Real World, like do any production stuff in there, or were you just listening?
No, just it was just there. Just that was listening. Where they were doing the they were working there. Yeah. So.
I really want to do something in that studio. It looks amazing.
Yeah, like good place for like tracking worldly sound.
That's like literally my goal one day is to build a studio like that.
It's so nice, wouldn't it?
You need Peter Gabriel money, though.
Definitely. You need a sledgehammer, don't you?
You need a fuck ton of money for that.
Literally. I know, mate. You know, it would just be nice to have a room that sounds properly accurate.
Yeah.
Like, just speak it around, like, the shape of it. I've moved the speakers and stuff, and suddenly, like, the low end is odd. I'm finding it really hard to get used to what's going on in this room.
Yeah. This place here, where in the UK, my studio, it's like, I'm just so used to it, so I know what it sounds like.
Yeah, completely, man. Which is, I think that's one of the main things.
In
the inadequacies of the room, but it doesn't matter because your brain, like, recalibrates it.
Just gets used to it, yeah.
Perfectly made records.
Yeah.
I'm liking it.
In Detroit, my studio, I got an acoustician to, like, do a load of work in it, and...
How's that? Is
it game-changing, but it took me so long to get used to.
Yeah, that's it. Because it might be so like technically perfect, but it just spins you out.
I also don't have the right speakers in there. The speakers aren't big enough for the room.
Right.
I need to spend a shit ton of money on good speakers to then fit the room.
Oh God, the actual size of the room.
Yeah.
Can you not just make the room smaller with like bass traps and, you know, like panels?
We've done a lot of that, but it's still like, it's quite a big, it's a nice size room. But realistically, the speakers, I only use the Adam A7s, and they're not powerful enough.
Yeah, that's what we used to have those, actually.
Yeah, they're solid.
Still got
one of them blue. How fucking loud were you playing it?
I know. Oops.
Okay, so let's talk about Jody Wisternoff and how that kind of happened.
Yeah, 2005 was when I first... made. So this is after the Way Out West tour with Fakers and stuff, and America, and then it felt like a little bit of a break from Way Out West. So chilled for a minute. 2005, Culture at Hot Girl was the first track I put out my own name, and this is when Beatport just started as well. And it did. I think it got to number one in Beatport, but that was really easy because I think you used to sell 10 copies. But I was happy. I was like, oh, brilliant! I'm number one.
Love that.
So that was quite cool, man. So that was like the kickoff of doing my own thing, I suppose.
And then when did that Anjuna thing kind of start with you?
That would have been 2010. So there was like 5 years in between.
Okay, yeah.
But something really bad happened in between that. I got tinnitus.
Okay, damn.
At a specific show in like Lithuania, 2006. And that basically was a bit of a life changer, really. Yeah. It's weird, man. It's just kind of, because I was so used to like, basically before that, I didn't have earplugs. Like, do you use earplugs now?
I've used earplugs since I was 12.
Yeah. Good move, man. Like, really good move. I mean, I've used them, since then.
Yeah.
Since 2006. But I do remember going to get them fitted when I was around like 21-ish.
Yeah.
On what's that street in London? Like, they do them, Harley Street.
Yeah.
Went there, had the molds taken. She like put them in, and I just felt really odd. And I was like, okay. And I said, I'll be back and like go and get the cash to pay for them. And I just chipped off, and I was like, never went back, and I regret that to this day. It's like, damn.
Yeah.
But yeah, the tinnitus thing is a funny one because it's kind of like something that you just. I don't think it's actually noise damage because it can be really quiet one day and then really loud the next day. And I think it's more like a nervous system kind of.
It scares the shit out of me, mate.
Yeah. Well, have you got any at all?
I get it occasionally, but I don't think it's like one day out every like 3 months, one of my ears might just ring.
Just for a little bit. That's fine. That's recalibration. That's your inner ear recalibrating itself. Don't worry about that. That's cool.
I still shit myself when that happens.
Yeah, it's weird. Everything goes quiet, doesn't it, for a minute, and then it goes.
And sometimes it lasts a couple of hours.
But yeah, man.
And it's like, oh fuck.
Yeah, man. Well, hardcore, mate. So I've actually kind of. It's always there a little bit, and I think loads of people. It's always that. And even if you go, like, there's an experiment. If you go into a quiet room, you will hear tinnitus. So it is actually just the sound of the brain.
Yeah.
And what happens is your brain filters it out because it's useless information. You know what I mean? It's just useless shit. You don't need to hear how your brain's, the nervous impulses and stuff like that. But noise damage, trauma can trigger that. Obviously you smash a plate, your ears will ring for a few minutes. But, so this, something, I just remember being a gig in like 2006 in Lithuania, and it was the loudest I've ever heard of system. I was there saying to Lucy, like, this is too much, you know what I mean? But I think we're like, afterwards got really pissed, dancing by the speaker for hours, just hammered, you know what I mean? Like, really got too loose. Next day I was like, fuck, the ring's still there. Then for some reason just focused on it, and I just went in, basically.
That's rough.
It was just hardcore, mate. It was like, so there was definitely a bit of a dark time around then.
Always the acceptance of it, right?
Yeah, it took a while, man. It affected me for about a year, I'd say, at that point, because I just went odd. My brain zoomed into the signal, and I just attached a red flag to it. And, I had to deal with that, basically. Yeah. And I think a lot of people, it's a journey that some people go through.
Yeah, I know Psy, Shadow Child, has it quite bad as well.
Like, it's just a reflection of your state. You can use it as a guide to being healthier, though, because it is sound of your nervous system, and it just lets you know if you're pushing it too hard. So it's like
interesting. I've never heard that.
Yeah, if you study like the sort of actual mechanics of it, there's, if the actual noise damage thing that just makes you not hear as well. But the reason tinnitus becomes a feedback loop is all down to the psychology. And the fact that you think it's a danger, and then your brain picks up on it. So the key is to relax and realize that it's not a threat. But you can't see that overnight.
It's like anxiety
doesn't just go; it fades.
So is your tinnitus better than it was?
It was. It took me a few years for it to chill, and then I had like a really long period of it not mattering at all.
Yeah.
I was like helping out loads of people as well, because I made it public that I'd suffered with it, so people would call me up and. I was like therapizing people a little bit, so that's cool. But yeah, then COVID just fucked it again, basically.
Really?
And it's only just fading now. I'm just only just having really good days again where I don't care about it. I think the virus triggered it again, or triggered something in my nervous system. So yeah, it was. So the badness came back, man.
Fucker.
Yeah, it's so weird.
It's amazing how sensitive our bodies are as well, right? And how much we fuck them, how much we abuse our bodies, and how resilient they are. And then one day it's like, no. Game over. Yeah. You're not having it.
Isn't it? You really got to just, you just got to be good to yourself.
Yeah. How do you do that with writing music then? Because I like to write loud.
I write with NS10s, basically. A nice reasonable volume. And then I pump it up when I'm doing a mixdown. But then I find if you're working too loud, you're not actually, you can kind of lose the plot a little bit.
Yeah.
As what's, you get vibe, but I find it really hard to mix loud. You've got to go from loud to quiet and stuff like that.
Yeah. Totally.
You know, but it's just kind of, you know, it all depends what stage of the writing you're dealing with. I think the one thing you've got to be careful is headphones loud. That's more of a danger than speakers loud.
Yeah.
So
I think that's the amazing thing about these noise cancelling things now, is that the reason why I used to have headphones super loud is because everything outside was so loud. Whereas with noise cancelling, like, I literally have my, like, if I'm listening to a podcast, I literally have my headphones on like one click up.
It's mad, isn't it?
I don't need it that loud. And I think it's really important that, because there's how many times you've been on a bus or on a plane or somewhere in public and you can hear somebody else's like music and you're like, you're fucking your ears.
Yeah, it is mental. Yeah. That's definitely cause a few little issues.
It's not good. Not good at all.
Yeah.
Okay. So from five years of Jody Wistanoff and Juno, and then it gets to where you're at.
Like, when did that, I'd say 2010 was the first. It's a track called Lasso. I think that James signed to one of the Andrew and Deep two or three.
Yeah.
Like the competitions. Then 2013 is when they asked if I could come and have a meeting with them to discuss possibly being more involved.
Yeah.
As you know, the year before that, I did the album with them, I think. Charles and Blaze. I think that was 2012.
Okay.
So that's cool. You know, just blah, blah, blah. Alan McGrath was like the guy I was working with then.
Yeah.
For like, you know, A&R and stuff like that. It's quite funny how they go from like A&R to artist management. Yeah. To blah, blah, blah. I mean, then someone else comes in, does that bit, and then they go. So yeah, man. But yeah, and then 2013 was when sort of joined forces in a more, you know, kind of involved way, really. I went up to the office, had a chat, and James is like, you know, do you want to mix Deep and June Deep 5 with me? And I was like, yeah, cool. So
that's dope.
Yeah. And then still doing them. That's number 13 now. So
that's mental.
Every year I'm like, you know, we finish one and James is like, right, so yeah, let's crack on with the next one. I'm like, great. Chill, Winston. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Madness. It's amazing how powerful that label is.
Crazy, man. It's changed so much as well. We couldn't get any shows at first when we first went out, like Deep 5, Deep 6. Like, there was just, it was impossible to book tours. There was just no interest at all. Mad. And then you look at what's going on now. It's bizarre, man.
It's mental.
Yeah.
It's like Anjuna's, I'd say, one of the biggest labels in the world.
Yeah, it's wild, isn't it? It's really just fascinating. I think it's because it's like a two-pronged attack. It's all the trance fans and then all the house guys as well. And then everything in between.
Yeah. But I think it's also, it's just consistency, right?
But it's a lot of records. They put out one a week.
Yeah.
it's wild. And pretty much, it's almost like when I used to buy the R&S records, it was like my favorite label back in the day. You could almost just buy it without listening to it because
you knew what you were going to get.
Invested in the brand and you trusted their A&R to be only putting out good things.
Yeah.
But I suppose, I think there's a degree of you know, trust in what's being delivered, I suppose.
No, I love that. I love that. And they are very consistent with what they put out.
Some of it's frightening.
And what they've done, like with like some artists, if you know what I mean, and how they've like grown artists out of it. Obviously, you've been part of the furniture for years there.
People like Lane 8 and stuff like that.
Ben Bomber. I think my video is about 1 second. Let me switch videos because my camera has just dropped a bomb.
Ooh.
There we go. Oh, I've got the new Mac, and the new Mac is,
how is it?
It's fucking amazing. And yeah, this is the new camera.
The M1 ones, yeah?
Yeah. The M1. And the camera's really good on it.
It
looks pretty good.
Now, I was going to get the new one. I think just before the end of the tax year, like I bought one.
Yeah.
Like, and then, but the money didn't actually go through. So it was like, wait a minute. Because did it as a tax write-off. And then I was like, wait a minute, it hasn't actually happened. So I packed it off like last week. So I was like, yeah, money's just about to go. I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah,
I've paid for it already. Nah, fuck it. So, but my one at the moment is still rocking. I can't be bothered to install all the new shit.
That's the thing, is I bought mine in March.
Yeah,
but I didn't get it till last week.
I'm quite jealous actually.
But they've just announced a new one yesterday.
They always do that. As soon as you get one, they announce a new one.
A new one.
Yeah, but there'll be problems with the new one, and like it's only now that a lot of the software will work on the one you've got.
Yeah.
So. Cutting edge is always a bleeding edge, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I
should never have the latest when it's just come out, because nothing will work on it.
Wise words from Jody Wissanoff right there. Wise words.
Cutting edge is always a good
So what have you got coming up? What have you got planned?
At the moment, just the rest of the year, I've just booked every weekend, basically. I don't feel the need to put out any music, because there's no point.
Is that literally where you're at?
Yeah, and I'm working on loads and loads of stuff. Like, I'm working on new Way Out West album.
Yeah. Oh, sick.
So this is tracks, you know, we're just pottering on, you know, building things up, and then just got loads of my own ideas on the go.
How does that feel, not having any pressure to do anything?
Yeah, like, it's mad to not have to put out an album to get a tour off the back of it. This is really weird to actually, but you know, it's just really nice having an agent who knows what they're doing.
Who knows it, yeah.
It's like you can just relax and make music with no pressure of the schedule. Even though I do have to get another record done, and there is, you know, as I said, there's loads going on. There is, you know, I am working on an album. There's remixes I'm doing. We're working on Deep 14 at the moment as well. Yeah. So building up the box for that.
Do you prefer working on like an album rather than singles?
Yes, definitely. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I don't like just putting out random singles, really. Yeah. I'd rather do an album and then release singles from it.
Yeah.
Because I don't know, it just feels like a bit more substantial.
Cool.
It's just the way it just always seems to have happened, really.
Love it, man.
I just like to work. It's unlike you. You seem to be someone who can work on a track and make it and follow it through. You know, I'm just the opposite. I just need to have loads that I can just dip in and out of.
Yeah, no, I'm very much
for 10 minutes. That's just where it's always been.
Yeah, I'm very much like write a record and finish it and then move on to the next. But I'm trying to change how I work.
I'll tell you what though, I think the reason that's what it used to be like for us, because it had to be, because it was on the mixing desk. So you couldn't work on two tracks at once.
Yeah.
It would be all the settings would be on the desk. And so if you work on something else, you completely fuck up the track.
Because, yeah.
You know, you got to start from scratch. We never had the luxury of being able to jump around, so we had to. Therefore, that's why I love how it is now.
Yeah, I'm
because you never had to work like that. That's why you are working like that.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah,
I think also I'm trying to give myself time to write, to spend longer on tracks rather than just finish them off and actually try and redo them and like make them as good as I possibly can, rather than just like writing a record, it's done, bin it off, or like release it or whatever. So it's a process.
Yeah, man. How many years have you actually been making music then?
I started writing records when I was 15.
Yeah, wicked. That's good. So you've got a lot of experience.
Done it for a while, yeah. But I still, at this moment in time, I feel like I've lost like a massive amount of confidence into like where I want to, like, I know what I want to write, but I just can't do it. I'm just not giving myself enough time to like go and make it.
It's tricky one, isn't it? Because, you know, your tour schedule is insane as well. So, yeah.
It'll get there.
You can't complain.
No.
You know?
I just want to make really fucking great music. And I want to make
really fucking great music.
Yeah, but for me, I'm like this always the want to make better music.
Yeah. No, I think everyone's like that, really. Yeah. Because if you think you've made the best track you're ever going to make,
you're
then
fucked.
Yeah, you're completely buggered, aren't you?
Yeah, it's game over.
You find that a lot of time you're making the track and you're just trying to. There's not something you're copying, but there's something you've been really inspired by. Mm. And that's like, so for me, Cold Drink the Hot Girl was me trying to make Body Language.
Yeah.
By Matt. So that was the template for that. Even okay. Nothing like it.
Yeah, it's yeah.
Like, you know, it's kind of quite often there'll be something that is just so inspiring and like different that you just want to try to not better it, but sort of mimic it a bit. And then you end up doing something,
completely different. Yeah.
So yeah, it's interesting stuff, man.
Amazing, dude. We've just done an hour and 40 minutes.
Yeah, wicked. Really nice chat.
Let's wrap this up. Thank you so much for coming on, man. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. And I've been loving watching your chats with people as well. And I think it's a really nice way you've done it, where you just do it every single week. And I think it's a brilliant thing to start during lockdown as well.
Thanks, man. It kept
people sane, I think, and, you know, like communicating with each other. So, yeah.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate it, especially coming from you. Like, I've loved your stuff over the years, and I've loved what you've done for the industry. It's been amazing. And to see somebody have a career as long as you have and keep going and keep growing, it's pretty special.
It is nice, man. If people look at that and think that's something that happens and can happen, then it's great. You know what I mean? It's just inspiring, isn't it?
Yeah, I love it.
Just chilling down, so yeah, man. And it'd be good to actually see you in the flesh as well.
Yeah, let's do dinner. I'm back in this. I'm pretty much back all summer until August.
Okay.
So the next couple of weeks I'm not, but then I'm back every week during, and then I'm off every weekend. So yeah, we should definitely catch up.
Let's figure this out.
Let's get some lunch or something.
Flash.
Cool, mate. Exactly. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, no, thank you so much, mate. I loved it.
Keep safe. See you soon.
Take care, mate.
Big
Bye.
Love. Bye, mate. And that is a wrap. Big love to Jody for coming on. Love that conversation. Hope you enjoyed it. Please share. Please send it to everybody. Give us some reviews. Give us some comments. It keeps the podcast going. Big love. Keep safe. See you next time.
Every day, we rise, challenging ourselves to work for what we believe in. At U.S. Border Patrol, protecting our borders is more than a job. It's a calling. Agents answer the call, working together to keep our country and communities safe. If you are ready for a new mission, join U.S. Border Patrol and go beyond. Learn more at cbp.gov/careers.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.